It was launched in February 2018, as you will know, by the Prime Minister. And it's a very good example of asking the right question. This is the first report, government report, since the Robbins report of 1963, to look at both parts of the post-18 sector together. And we took both parts of the mandate, further education and higher education, very, very seriously indeed. We knew about the 50% of young people who now go to university. We didn't know so much when we began, despite the expertise on the panel of Professor Alison Wolfe. We didn't know so much about the experience of the 50% of young people who don't go to university, or the vast majority of adults out there in the population who don't have a degree but who might want to return to education later in life. And we concentrated as much on that second group as on the first group. This evening, I suspect, much of our discussion will actually be about the university sector. But before we move on to that, I just want to share with you some of our thoughts and some of our findings on HE and adult education. We were surprised, probably even shocked, I think, by the decline in the numbers of people participating in further education over the last 10, 20 years and longer. It's a remarkable decline. It's driven by funding, which has collapsed, and it has led, we believe, to quite pressing economic issues in terms of skills gap and some element of social injustice. Our proposals concentrate on reforming and refunding the FE sector through a reformed suite of qualifications, through a reintroduction of free level 2, level 3 entitlements. We were surprised to find that of the 40% of the population who leave school at GCSE level or below, almost none of them progress to some form of further education. When you understand that, you start to understand the nature of our divided society. And as a panel, we were determined to do that. So reform and refund the FE college network, capital injection, restore level 2, level 3 entitlements, group level 4, 5, higher technical qualifications around a reformed employer-led suite. A huge proposal, a suite of proposals, which we hope government will listen to very carefully. We also focus carefully on the disadvantaged section of the population, and we note with a great deal of pleasure the increased numbers of disadvantaged students going into higher education. We felt that we wanted to know more about their experiences when they were there. There are still considerable issues: access to the better universities, the performance of lower attainment students when they're at universities, their job prospects afterwards. We wanted to reflect this group's interests by reintroducing maintenance grants, the absence of which we think is a psychological barrier to participation. We felt that lowering the fee, as I'll talk about in a few moments, will also add to that. We felt that we needed to understand much more about how the access and participation, the outreach money, is spent. We wanted to do what we could to introduce the amount of money that is available to support disadvantaged students while they're at university. So this really, and I'm about to get on to my talk, but this really is a plea. Let's not forget the other 50%. Let's not forget the vast majority of adults out in the population who don't have a degree, many of whom would like to return to education to improve their life chances, to improve their employment prospects. It's a really big issue. I really hope that those of you who work in this sector and also will in the HE sector will find the time and the conviction and the commitment to keep arguing this case. It's something that the panel felt really very, very strongly about. I will now talk about what I think you've asked me to talk about, because this is a meeting organised by a body whose purpose is to, quote, to provide an impartial platform for the debate of technology issues that have a science, technology, or medical element. And obviously, on the panel, we focused a lot of time and attention on just these issues. I thought what it would be helpful to do would be just to take you through, just to share our thought process with you, to explain to you how we reached the conclusions that we did reach and what those conclusions are. So right at the beginning of our 15-month journey, back in February and March, we asked ourselves how the current system of post-18 education matches up with the country's economic needs. We, of course, as you would expect with three professors on the panel, understand the importance of knowledge for its own sake, learning for its own sake, the importance of ideas, culture, creativity in producing a really rounded country. But the bulk of, and we spoke a lot about that at our meetings, but the bulk of my remarks this evening are going to be much more practical. So how does post-18 education measure up against what we think the country needs? To find out, we turned to the government's industrial strategy. It puts it very nicely. By 2030, we want the UK to be the most innovative country in the world, a home to the most dynamic businesses, at the cutting edge of new technologies and processes. So how are we doing against that benchmark? In the panel's judgment, the answer is mixed. We observed much excellent work going on in universities. It's reflected in the sector's preeminence in research rankings, in the remarkable share of citations and downloads enjoyed by academics working in English universities. The report is England only, I should say. We noted with pleasure the close collaboration with industry in universities such as Sheffield and Warwick, and indeed Brunel, and many more. But we also heard frequently from employers and expert academics that this country has a skills gap, particularly in science and technology. Again, I turn to the industrial strategy document. It says 40% of employers reported a shortage of STEM graduates as being a key barrier in recruiting appropriate staff. In jobs in science, research, engineering and technology are expected to rise at double the rate of other occupations between now and 2023, and the majority of jobs on the Home Office shortage occupation list are in either STEM-related roles or industries. Below graduate level, the situation is also concerning. Once again, the objective of the industrial strategy is admirable. It says technical education has historically not been valued as highly as academic success, and standards have been lower. We want, says the industrial strategy, our technical education system to be as prestigious as higher education in this country, and for it to rival the best systems in the world. Once again, there is some excellent work going on at specific institutions. I and panel members visited some of them. But we're a long way short of fulfilling that objective. There is less than 200,000 people studying at level 4 or 5 at the higher technical level, compared to over 1 million degree students. And relatively few of the 190,000 higher technical students are actually found in STEM-related areas. As the Prime Minister noted when she launched the post-18 panel report this week, in Germany, 20% of 25-year-olds hold a higher technical qualification, yet the figure in the UK is just 4%. So many of our proposals that relate to the reforming and refunding of technical and vocational education, built around a stronger network of FE colleges, a new suite of employer-focused higher technical qualifications, and opportunities and incentives for universities to widen their offer at this level are intended to address this problem. However, I imagine that this audience will be particularly interested in our proposals for higher education and how they relate to science and technology. So this is really where I want to take you as briskly as I can through the panel's thought process. We started by examining the principle of the income contingent loan system, which, as you will know, shares the cost of provision between the state in the form of loan write-off and a bit of grant, and the student. When it was introduced 20 years ago, it became the means of expanding HE, a development which the panel heartily endorses and very much welcomes. And the panel believes that this principle, the principle of sharing the cost between public and private beneficiaries, is correct. So with that principle in mind, we then progressed to examining the fee structure, starting with the trebling of tuition fees in 2012. Again, we felt that in principle, the principle of increasing fees was the right thing to have done, correcting a long period of underinvestment in higher education. But then we took it a level down and started looking at the consequences of this big increase on the different teaching bands. For the lowest cost subjects, the new fee cap was higher than the old fee plus grant system. And so the lowest cost subjects would get no grant under the new arrangements. Higher cost subjects got the trebled fee, but a smaller grant than under the old scheme. It was expected that universities would price at below the cap to reflect the cost of provision. In fact, nearly all went straight to the maximum fee level. The consequence of this, according to IFS analysis, is that between 2011-12 and 2016-17, the lowest cost Band D subjects received a 47% increase compared to a 6% increase for the highest Band A subjects, clinical medicine. The other bands are shown in figure 3.6 of the panel's report. Is that 3.6? So really, the bands are across the top. It's the 2011-12 system, the top half of the page, the 2016-17 system, bottom half of the page, and then the bottom line is the change in funding between those years, so plus 6% for Band A, 19% for Band B, 27% for C1, 24% for C2, and 47% for Band D. This produced significant distortions in university spending by subject. And the next figure, these are, by the way, I should say, these are taken from the panel's report. The next figure, this is figure 3.7, this shows the change in income by subject per student over the years. Note the bottom six subjects: veterinary science, physics, chemical engineering, clinical medicine, general engineering, and biosciences. For STEM subjects, the consequences of this reallocation of resources were profound. In responding to our call for evidence, the Russell Group told us, and I quote from their submission, strategically important high-cost subjects remain underfunded with an estimated £90 million deficit across all Russell Group universities in England for undergraduates in subjects in bands A and B, clinical and lab-based subjects. This is an area where the system could be refined to support innovative delivery of research-intensive STEM subjects, which are critical to meeting the future skill needs of the UK. We then looked at this in another way. We wanted to see how the resource allocation in total lined up with industrial strategy priorities. Does the taxpayer subsidy from the expected student loan write-off reflect the government's stated strategic objectives? So now figure 3.10. There is in this, you can see some resemblance to industrial strategy, but we still see maths and computer science and engineering at the bottom of the table. Then figure 3.11 shows how this has moved over time. This makes clear the unintended consequences of the 2012 fee change and the near universal adoption of the maximum fee. Engineering, you'll see, is particularly interesting. Then what we did was to multiply the per student funding by the number of students to work out the total taxpayer subsidy per subject. And that's shown on figure 3.12. And if I could summarise that, of the £8 billion taxpayer subsidy last year, STEM subjects received much less than half. We judged that in a system the cost of which would soon rise to £14 billion on credible forecasts, some changes were needed to resource allocation to align with industrial strategy priorities. We looked at a number of options, including differential fees, which we rejected on the grounds that they would, in all probability, reinforce flawed incentives. We examined keeping the fee at £9,250 with a negative teaching grant to rebalance to the cost of provision. We rejected this on the grounds that it would still leave too many students paying more than what some analysis we used an accounting firm to do showed us was the reasonable cost of provision. Our recommendations, therefore, are as follows. A fee cap of £7,500 by 2021-22, with government replacing in full the lost fee income by increasing the teaching grant, leaving the average unit of funding unchanged at sector level in cash terms. We recommended that the fee cap, effectively the unit of resource under our recommendations, once you take account of the increased grant, we recommended that should be frozen until 2022-23, but thereafter be increased in line with inflation. We recommended that the grant, which we regard as an essential part of the package, that needs to be topped up in full. That grant should reflect the cost of provision per subject, the social and economic value to the state and to the student, and that would be the Office for Students' responsibility. We recognise that this could cause issues for specialist institutions of high quality, and we recommend that if necessary, they should be protected. So my final figure, 3.15, shows how this might work for the various subject groups. And you will see that the lower fee under our 7,500 proposal allows for a more differentiated approach to the different subject bands. The lower fee, in essence, would create the headroom to enable greater differences of funding between subjects which could then be aligned with the country's economic needs. I will stop at that point, if I may, and hand over to the next speaker.